Time to take a look at science, science research, and education with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, and William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in today. And as you listen to us, and maybe you've got some thoughts or questions about science or science research, we hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. But Sam, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Larry, and to everyone in the listening audience.
It's a great start for a new year. I noticed that you had some holiday presents, Christmas presents,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, I got it. Santa Claus was very good to me this year, not only in the Christmas lecture, but also on Christmas Day itself, I got several good books. One is the latest book by Oliver Sacks called Musicophilia. I highly recommend this book. It is about music and the brain, how we get to appreciate what we hear and how music really affects our mood and so on. And Oliver Sacks, the famous neurologist, who wrote a lot of popular books, including The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, a very, very outstanding book. Another book that I really started reading and I'm enjoying is Michael Pollan's The Omnivorous Dilemma.
Oh, Omnivore's Dilemma.
This is a really fascinating book. I got a few other books, but I haven't started working on them yet. And we're off to a good year, and I just think that it is important for all of us to think about what we want to do in the new year and beyond as to help us understand the role of science in our daily lives and the role of being responsible for the action that we take when it comes to, the news item just said now that a barrel of oil is over $100. So to be concerned about important chemicals, and as I was saying to you, Larry, there are at least three important chemicals that we should think about. One is natural gas. The major component in it is methane. It's a greenhouse gas. Another one is carbon dioxide, which comes from the combustion of fossil fuels, also a greenhouse gas. And then the most dominant greenhouse gas, which people don't think about very much, is water vapor. And how water is very essential to what we do in our daily lives. And the Great Lakes are, at some risk now. Water supplies all over the world are in need of careful attention so they can be purified and so on. So these are some of the thoughts that have been going through my head as we welcome the new year here.
Well, every one of our lines is filled. So let's start with Jim in Galena, Illinois. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding global warming. We hear so much about greenhouse gases and how they contribute. How does our drawing resources from the ground, burning them and turning them into heat energy, how does that contribute to global warming? And can we make any reduction by using solar energy or other resources that are available without drawing resources that are or that would never be converted into heat if they just stay in the ground? I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Jim. A very good question. Yes, we should continue to consider alternatives to fossil fuels. Let's be practical about this. Fossil fuels are with us, and they're going to stay. But we have to be very deliberate in looking at alternative sources of energy that are not only economically viable, but are also good for the environment. So every time we burn something that comes from the ground that has carbon in it, we produce carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide has been clearly identified as a major contributor to global warming. Global warming happens because the incident radiation from the sun hits the surface of the Earth and bounces back and gets trapped. Some of it gets trapped. The heat part gets trapped because of the presence of gases like carbon dioxide, methane, and water vapor. Mm-hmm. Now, water vapor is there because the oceans and all water bodies evaporate, contribute to evaporation and so on. So we can't really do much about that. But we are contributing very rapidly to the amount of carbon dioxide gas that's in the air. And so we should be conscious of how much related to our consumption, to our daily, weekly, monthly, yearly consumptions, we rely on sources of energy that produce heat, among other things, not just heat energy. You know, there are different types of energy that we use and rely on, electrical energy and so on. But how much they contribute to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide gas. Carbon dioxide gas is used in the photosynthetic process. It's plants converted into oxygen during the daytime. Mm-hmm. But the rate of increase of carbon dioxide has been now demonstrated to be so high to the point that we should not only be alarmed about it, we should be more responsible in our use of fuels that contribute to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide.
And thank you very much for calling. Nancy in Sussex, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm a kindergarten math teacher. And what I'm finding is that math and sciences are not being taught at a high enough level to younger children to make a difference as they get in older grades. And I guess my question is, you know, what could I as a teacher do to improve how sciences and math are being taught in very young grades?
Nancy, that's a very good question. And where do you teach, Nancy?
I teach in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin. Okay. And so one specific suggestion I make to you and to others in our listening audience to become very familiar with the science and math education standards that the state of Wisconsin and the neighboring states do. They have their own standards. Make sure that you know what these standards are and make sure that you communicate your concerns about implementing those standards in the school systems at all grades, but especially at the early stages, as you indicate, at the elementary level, because we need to have not only high-quality curriculum materials in the hands of teachers. We need to have qualified teachers who are part of an environment that nurtures the development of the young mind and nurtures the development of a healthy attitude towards science, indeed toward learning in general. So I'd say number one is learn more about those standards. Now, you may not agree with everything that is stated in those standards, but they are a very useful point of departure for a discussion with educators, with civic leaders, with political leaders as to what our school offerings are all about. So that's a very important step, I think, that all of us should be looking at. There are also national standards for science and mathematics education. They're set by the National Academy of Sciences and other groups. These are not federal standards. These are national standards. These are carefully thought through and articulated, aiming at improving the quality of science and math education in our school systems at all levels.
And, you know, Exxon has committed, just as we talk about this, Exxon has committed $125 million to help teachers improve math and science education in our schools. And I think there's 12 universities got $25 million grants across the country for the national expansion of this UTeach program. Are you familiar with that program? And does that relate to what Nancy's talking about here?
Yes, it does, actually. UTeach is a program that started about 10 years ago at the University of Texas. And now ExxonMobil has picked up the success that they've had in the past 10 years and expanded it into nationally. The program is aimed at recruiting and training teachers to make them qualified to teach high-quality materials at all levels. And so this is an important activity. People might say, cynically, okay, ExxonMobil, $125 million, what's that? Well, you know what? It's a very important step. I'm not an apologist for industry, but I just say it's an important step because if we take up the benefits that can accrue from using those funds to train teachers and to have the teachers stay in the school system, then I think we can demonstrate the utility of such support from industry, which in the past has led to increased support from federal and state sources. So,
yeah.
So I think UTeach is a very important development that has now been put in place, and it's spread into several states and Wisconsin and the upper Midwest are not included in the funding so far. Places like Florida, Colorado, Kentucky, California, and so on. But it doesn't mean we can't be part of that. And I think it's important for everyone to find out a bit more about this program and how we can become eligible to receive such funds.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy, you wanted to add something.
Yes, I just basically wanted to say I thank you very much for your comments. It's really encouraging to hear that what I'm doing is valued, because many times what I find is that teachers who don't have the content knowledge prefer to stay with what's always been done rather than move to a higher level and learn what needs to be learned in content to be able to teach what needs to be taught. So I thank you very much for the conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Nancy, for calling.
Thank you, Nancy. And I just, if I may add one other comment about content and knowledge. Not every teacher knows everything at any one time. So it's perfectly all right to say in the classroom and elsewhere, if something comes up that the teacher is not knowledgeable enough about, to say, I don't know the answer to that specific question, but I know how to find out. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important to be nurturing the questioning skills of youngsters and adults as well. And it's very okay to say, I don't know the answer to something if you really don't know it. Because if you give a false answer, then that's very misleading and people catch on to that.
All right. Thanks again, Nancy, for calling. Appreciate it. Ray in Madison, I think, is next. Then Joe. Ray, hello.
Hello. My question has to do with it's something that's sort of at the crux of a few different controversial issues, and not that I want to debate those on this particular program, but rather the scientific principles behind them. And basically, for me, I'm seeing some confusion between when is something a theory and when is it considered proven. For example, with gravity, I heard recently that gravity is not considered like a proven fact of science. And I remember in school hearing that for something to be a proof, it has to pass certain standards of having been observed and no exceptions to it and things like that, and observed many times over. And, you know, for things from evolution and, you know, embryonic stem cell research and a few different issues, it seems kind of important to be able to discern between what do we know as scientific fact, you know, because it's been proven, and, you know, laws of physics versus things that, you know, for now or forever will always remain within the realm of theory.
Okay. All right.
Well, good question, Ray. And the interplay between theory and observations is at the very heart of what we do in science. So, for example, we make observations about the natural world that we live in, and then we collect these observations, we validate them, and then we propose a theory. The theory is a collection of explanations of the observations that have been made, and the theory is said to be valid until another observation is made that cannot be explained by that theory. So a new theory then is proposed that would include explanations for the new observations, but also validate the previous theory. So this is how progress in science is made. So theories are not handed down on a tablet. Theories are developed as a way to explain observations and to put together the results of mathematical considerations that have to do with observations that have been made. So there is, and the point, Ray, that I think you wanted to allude to but didn't is the conflict that people say exists between the theory of evolution and other such theories. Or the theory of gravity, for example. So I hope my comments have clarified a bit what theories are. A theory is not something that is pulled out of the air. It is related to observations and considerations that are done very carefully and methodically, and is subject to scrutiny and is subject to being disproven. That is, again, how progress in science is made. Once a theory is proposed, it is fair game for everybody to look at it and examine it and see what it really says and what it explains, and indeed what it does not explain.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Ray, for calling. Joe in Belleville will come to you next, but just a reminder, we're talking science research, and education with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. If you'd like to join in, we have some open lines at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking science research, and education today with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. Join us at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's turn to Joe in Belleville next. Joe, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Dr. Shakashiri. I'd like to ask you if there is a scientist shortage, and if so, how it will manifest itself, let's say, in the next 20 to 30 years. And also, if there really is one, why there are so many postdocs out there on their 10th year of postdocs?
Again, a good question, Joe. When people talk about shortages, they have some idea in mind as to what is really desirable by way of a number of scientists or engineers and so on. I don't have any such number in mind. What I view as a shortage, not only in terms of scientists and engineers, I view that the public at large has a shortage in understanding science principles and the role of science and technology in our society. Now, how does this understanding develop? It comes because scientists contribute to advancing knowledge and to explaining those advances. There are many reports that say that the United States is falling behind in its scientific and technological workforce, and we don't have enough native-born students at our schools and universities going into science and technology. And the government has, the federal government has set in place several programs aimed at increasing that number. So in that sense, there is the view that, yes, there is a quote-unquote shortage of scientists and technologists. Now, you say, how can we make a statement like that when we have a number of postdocs that are yet to be employed? That is a placement issue. That is an issue that has to be looked at very carefully and very fairly. I think it is wrong to encourage people to go into a career where the jobs are not going to be there. I think it is wrong to be misleading and say that if you go to college, you'll get a good job, if in fact it's known that that's not going to be the case. I know it's going to be the case. I think and I believe that educated people have a much better chance at getting jobs either in the technical fields that they were trained in or in other human endeavors. To me, education is the key. It can be a scientific education. It can be legal education. It can be education in any area, because education empowers the individual and consequently the society that the individual is in to open new possibilities for employment and for contributions. Does that address your question, Joe?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, Joe. Sally in Middleton, it's your turn next. Hi, Sally.
Hello. Thanks very much. It's odd. I hadn't expected to be calling. In fact, I thought I'd be on my way to the market. But I was reading in the November issue of the Smithsonian about the Ganges River, and it's so upsetting that I don't know what to do about it. The Hindu religion, and here again, religion, you know, is wonderful, but it's not science, and it prevents anything being done by that horrible sewer that is the Ganges that they still worship, drink, and bathe in. And what on earth? I know you have to get political. You were just saying how important education is. And, of course, that's the basis of everything. They don't know about it, evidently. I mean, they throw corpse that when someone dies and they can't afford a funeral, they just put the body by this holy river. And so you have the dogs. It's just, I mean, how are we, where are we today in the world that among humanity we can let that happen?
Well, Sally, I'm glad to hear that you'll read the Smithsonian, and I hope you read other magazines as well. It's a very fine publication. Yes, it's important when we read something that's being done, not only in our country but elsewhere, to really learn more about it and learn more about the customs and the culture in which whatever is being done is being done. That doesn't make it right, nor does it make it wrong. But it's important to develop a deeper understanding of why certain practices are done and how we can, as educated people, as educated societies, protect the environment that we are in, not only for our own personal protection, but for the protection of others. So I would say, please go back and read this article. I have not read this article, but I know about the subject that it deals with. And let us all try to learn something about the culture of the people that we want to interact with and hopefully help improve the quality of their lives and the quality of the environment that they're in.
Thank you very much for calling, Sally. I appreciate your call. And I want to give some others a chance to get on here as well. So let's go to Jackie in Simmons, Wisconsin. Jackie, hello.
Hi. It's Plymouth, but that's fine.
Plymouth, okay.
No problem. Couple things. One was, could you, going back to the caller around theory, could you also speak about, because I often hear people banter around the word fact. It's not a fact. And could you talk about that in relationship to theory, and particularly around, you hear that a lot with naysayers on global warming. Another question related to global warming is, you don't hear anything about development in terms of how that's relating to global warming. And I'm talking about development in developing land sprawl, development in terms of housing and other buildings and not having enough sinkholes or places to absorb the carbon CO2, as well as all the animal loss. And then a third one was, can you say something about what's going on with methanol, the idea of methanol being another approach to dealing with CO2?
Mm-hmm.
So those are three important questions for me.
All right.
Thank you, Jackie. So let's talk about facts and theory and give an example from for example, we learned that sodium chloride, table salt, is a white solid. That's a fact. We all make mm-hmm. the observation. That's what it is. It can be analyzed. We can say its chemical formula is NaCl, sodium chloride. It's soluble in water. So when you put it in water, it dissolves. That's a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We say that the solution of sodium chloride in water conducts the electric current. Those are observations that we make. And then we can construct a theory that explains these observations. So we say that the solution, the so-called aqueous solution of sodium chloride, has in it ions. Ions are charged particles. These ions carry the electric current, and thus we can explain the conductivity property of a solution of sodium chloride. So that's just an example of how mm-hmm. facts and theory come into play. And as Jackie and other people know, in the teaching of science, it's somewhat controversial as to which comes first. You say mm-hmm. you give the theory first and you use facts to illustrate it, or you make the observations empirically, collect them, examine them, see how they fit together, and so on. And that's a debate that goes on all the time in science. Now, the second point that she asked about is about
development of global warming.
Yeah. So there is a phrase now that we hear, and I'm happy that we hear it more and more. It's called sustainable development.
Mm-hmm.
Sustainable development refers to improving, making progress in new construction, in highways, and so on, but doing that in a way that sustains the environment that this new building is in, or this new road is in, or new bridge, and so on, and does not contribute to harming the environment. And a lot of economists and political leaders are supporting this approach, and it's important that we understand what that sustainable development really means and how it applies to projects that are taking place in our immediate community and elsewhere in our society. The third question she asked was about
methanol.
Methanol, yes. Methanol can be an alternative source of energy. But, you know, methanol has carbon and hydrogen in it. So mm-hmm. when it is used as a fuel, it's going to contribute to global warming because it will form mm-hmm. carbon dioxide. When it burns, it forms carbon dioxide and water vapor. Mm-hmm. So,
But use a plant, argue that for a second, if you're using plants to construct it, the plants themselves are taking carbon dioxide out of the air to grow. So you may be using there's less increase in carbon dioxide because you're taking it out of the air.
Well, you know, we hear about burning down rainforests and so on, and that removes trees from the environment, yeah. and therefore it reduces the conversion of carbon dioxide yeah. back. So that is really at the very heart of this discussion. Mm-hmm. In our own country, you know, 150 years ago or so, we tore down a lot. We took down a lot of trees, and so yeah. I mean that's how we built cities and so on. And so we made our own contributions to affecting the photosynthetic process. The key is that the net increase in carbon dioxide is the result of using fossil fuels. It's the net increase.
That's right.
And so, yeah, part of sustainable development is to be in a green environment, so-called green environment, mm-hmm. That is one that reduces emissions that are harmful to the environment, harmful to people, harmful to animals as well, and also is done in an economically viable way.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you very much, Jackie, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines now again, finally. You can get on with your question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Bob in Oconomowoc is next. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if you might be able to help me with an ongoing family argument. I have a son, Brian, who is studying applied physics down at Rice, a son, Eric, who's studying at UWM, and an ex-wife, Sheila, who actually teaches accounting at UWM. And I want to look at theory and go beyond that. I talk about the theory of evolution, and actually I contend that it's a principle of evolution. And they all gang up on me and say, no, it's bad, it's a theory. And you know, are we there, and how, take me there. How do we get to a principle or a law from a theory, and are we there with evolution?
I'm glad to hear that there are such conversations and discussions taking place. I am for conversation because that helps clarify certain points and beliefs and leads to new knowledge, I hope. You know, let's not get hung up on the labels. It's labels are important. Don't get me wrong, but let's not get hung up on them. What is important is to understand what the so-called theory is all about and how it has been put together and what it means. So when you look at the theory of evolution, this is based on a number of observations and validated conclusions made by scientists throughout the ages. Darwin is credited with starting us to think about evolution, although there is evidence in the literature that someone else before him started this too. So it is really important to understand what the laws are, what we mean by a law, what do we mean by a principle, what do we mean by a theory. That's important to know. But what's most important to know is what we actually do with this knowledge. And I submit, as I have said many times on Larry's program and elsewhere before, I submit in all these discussions where theory appears to be at conflict or in conflict or at odds with beliefs, religious beliefs, that the element of respect has to be part of the conversation. So that it's not respect for what the person is saying, it's respect for the person. And I think that is a very important part that is missing in all kinds of conversations and dialogues that take place nowadays between people who have certain religious beliefs and people who have certain scientific beliefs. I think it is very important to maintain civility and respect in these conversations so that it leads to affirming the beliefs that we have, whether they are scientific or religious, and it leads to understanding what the limitations are of whatever theory one is talking about.
Thank you very much for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call. And Chuck in Washington Island is next, so we go on to Chuck. Hello, Chuck.
Hi. Just wanted to say to Dr. S. that I really enjoy his Science is Fun TV show.
Thank you.
And when I was a kid in science class, one demonstration I really remember, the teacher had a beaker. He put in sugar, and then he added nitric acid. And I just thought it was really, really interesting. I thought it might be something you might consider for your show.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I enjoyed doing the program, and I'm very grateful that so many people who watch it send us email messages and correspond with us about it. And we're always looking for new ideas, but also time-honored experiments. So putting sugar in water, of course.
And acid.
Yeah, but you put the sugar in first, and, you know, that's dissolves, of course. Yeah. We all know that. And then you put the nitric acid in there, and you end up with an acidic solution of sugar. There is another experiment that's closely related to this one, and that is where you put the sugar, table sugar, sucrose, in a beaker, and you add to it sulfuric acid.
Mm-hmm.
And the sulfuric acid is a very powerful dehydrating agent. It loves water, and it removes all the water from sucrose, and you end up with a black column that comes shooting up from the beaker. Maybe that's the experiment that Chuck is talking about.
Could well be. It could well be. Thanks, Chuck. Kurt in Springbrook, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, I was wondering if Bassam is familiar with the environmentalist philosopher Derek Jensen's work.
Derek Jensen.
Tell me about him, Kurt.
Well, he wrote a book called Endgame. And,
oh, yes, I know that book. Okay, yeah.
And you mentioned sustainable development and the growth of cities before and how the forests were cut down to build cities. He has come up with a theory that cities, by definition, can never be sustainable because within the limits of a city, there's not enough resources to sustain a population. So they have to to sustain the population of the city, there has to be resources imported from out in the hinterlands. And so there is no such thing as sustainable development when you have the growth of cities. And civilization, by definition, then can be never really be sustainable simply because if you take more from your land base than you give back. And I was wondering what you think of that.
Yes, I don't agree that there is no such thing as sustainable development. But I am willing to go back and look at the book and look carefully at what you said and what the author says. It's not a zero sum game here. I think if you want development in a place where we live, yes, you need resources from someplace else, and you have to be responsible in acquiring these resources. Take mining, for example. We need minerals, we need metals, but we need to be responsible in how we mine them so that the process that we use does not contribute to badly to the environment. In gold mining, for example, cyanide is used. Cyanide can be very harmful to water supplies and to other forms to other parts of the environment there. So it's the recovery of the cyanide. It's the processes that we go through to recover that. And we have to factor into that whether the process is economically viable. There are many alternatives to fossil fuels now that can be used, but they're not used because they're not economically viable yet. It costs more to produce the catalysts that give us the fuels that we want, hydrogen, for example, than we can afford. So you have to be very careful, and we have to be more understanding as to what we really mean by sustainable development. That's a very good point, Kurt. As I said, I'm going to go back and read the end game. That's what you said is the name.
Yeah, the end game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Think even more carefully about what I say about sustainable development, but I'm not taking anything back.
Okay. And on that note, we'll close. Bassam, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. And your website is a great place to go for a lot of wonderful information, including, so we were talking a little bit about scientific science experiments, things you can do with your children or grandchildren, and there's some of those on there, and answers to a lot of other questions relating to science, and that is www.scifun.org. That's scifun.org. Take a look at that website. Bassam, thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Look forward to your next visit. Bassam Shakashiri is UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and William T. Heavu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at the issue of Wisconsin's uninsured children and families and what's going on, especially with UW Extension, Co-op Extension, to help ease that problem. Coming up next, a couple of guests, Roberta Ripertella and Rick Clemmie on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.